right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again for an update on something that we've actually covered in the past. At this point, Dom, how long has it been since the last time that we talked about Brexit?
It's been, I think, since mid-2018, so coming up on 2.5 years or longer now. And I've got to be honest, I'm a little daunted about this episode because we said, I think, in the middle of 2019 and then at various points last year that, oh, we really should do a Brexit follow-up. And then just as, firstly, the Brexit process itself was about to kick in, and then as the transition period was about to end and we would be really out for good, no takesy backsies this time, oh, maybe then we should do an episode. And each time we kept putting it off, to the point where more and more crazy events would be stacking up, and now there's no hope of possibly explaining all of them in any kind of detail, but hopefully we can get the big picture narrative sorted out there.
So I believe it is the case, and I will, I guess, preface this belief by saying for the real-time takes as they were going on in 2018, and I think the first one was in 2016, right around the time of that U.S. election as well, there is a lot of detail covered in those two podcasts, and hopefully we don't have to spend a ton of time today rehashing all of that. If you would be interested in the finer points of how we got at least to those particular scenarios, those podcasts are, of course, still available. Just Google Dom and Colin Brexit, and I think it should be easy enough to find. But since 2018, Dom, I believe we last left off at a point, and please correct me if I'm wrong about this, where Theresa May was either the prime minister or maybe even about to become the prime minister. Who was in charge when we last left off? Was it still in the David Cameron era?
It was firmly in the Theresa May government. But you were telling me before we came on that when you type in Dom and Colin Brexit, as you get towards the end of that, the autofill completes it with Dom and Colin breakup, which don't worry, don't you know, gasp and clutch your heart in despair as you see that. We are still, I mean, together sounds like the wrong word. We are going strong. Maybe it's the wrong word too. Whatever. And it got me wondering, maybe there's some like K-pop band called Dom and Colin or something, or there's some other unit that we're getting confused with, but never fear. Anyway. Yeah. So as of mid 2018, Theresa May, was, an embattled and somewhat embittered, prime minister who, after taking over and being in what looked like an incredibly dominant position politically, you know, that the world really was her oyster, she then called an election intending to cement her majority, scatter her political opponents before her, and really cement her position at the top of government. Instead, that backfired horrifically and hilariously, and we did an episode after that election, which you can go back and listen to if you want the details of that. But what was interesting in retrospect there, having had another general election since then, was that 2017 contest, even though the thing which kicked off Theresa May being prime minister in the first place was the Brexit vote, and even though the most recent political development of any kind before that election was called was Theresa May formally invoking Article 50, getting the Brexit process in motion, that election had shockingly little to do with Brexit. It almost vanished as an issue in that election, and it was almost like a typical domestic political contest, just about bread and butter, normal issues. By contrast, by the time we get to jumping ahead now to December 2019, when Boris Johnson is at the head of the Conservative Party, at which point you get this kind of freeze frame thing of, yeah, that's me, bet you're wondering how I ended up here. he crushes Jeremy Corbyn in that election, and that election was all about Brexit, because by that point Brexit fatigue had well and truly set in, and the slogan that they ran on in that election, it was the obvious one and the most effective one, was get Brexit done, and that really captured the mood of the public as a whole. Now, whether you can actually get Brexit done or whether Boris Johnson is the one to do it, those are totally different questions, which we will cover in some detail in due course. But yeah, when we left off, Theresa May was just struggling to get anything done, and in particular struggling to get anything done on Brexit, because that result, that act of self-sabotage, where she had this terrible campaign and the whole election went badly for her, and she decreased her own majority, led to the point where, you know, we had a parliament which agreed that it didn't want a no-deal Brexit. It agreed that it didn't want anything that you put before it, but it could not agree on what it did want. And so it would require a lot of political charm and finesse to get anything done under those circumstances. Theresa May had none of those. And so she kind of staggered on until her forced resignation effectively tipped her hand in 2019.
So if memory serves, when we were in here talking about this, either the first time or the second time, we were hot off of David Cameron essentially committing an all-time political unforced error to play his own way out of the prime ministry. Is that
sure? How it would be premiership? Yeah.
Sure. And it sounds like Theresa May did roughly the same thing. Is this the vote where it was like the all-time biggest margin in the history of Parliament was Theresa May's ultimate undoing?
That was one of many events along the way, yeah. And funny you should mention David Cameron, who, not to date this podcast, but currently at the news, at the heart of a growing and rapidly unraveling corruption scandal. So that's always...
That doesn't sound right.
No, of course not.
So we wind up ultimately with Boris Johnson, and I think you frame it well. Like, as soon as you said this, I had the mental image of Boris, like, being sworn in or shaking hands with the Queen or whatever it is, where he winds up like as prime minister, and then we flash back to him up on the zip line in the 2012 Olympics. Like, how did this possibly play out? But yeah, one way or the other.
But Boris with one hand on the Bible and the other hand with his fingers crossed behind his back. Yeah.
One way or the other, Boris, who we've talked about extensively for sure in our Brexit podcast prior to him ascending to the prime ministry, the premiership, I'm still unclear. How is Boris handling all of this?
Shambolically, but there are two aspects of that, because on the one hand, the idea of Boris Johnson being prime minister seems just essentially absurd in and of itself, and that's because he himself is an absurd figure, and he leans into that. That is his carefully crafted political persona, as well as who he truly is as a person. But when you look at his position in the larger political framework of the UK, in some sense, him ascending to that role has a kind of inevitability to it. And when, you know, Theresa May could not get anything done, there seemed to be no way through the Brexit deadlock that emerged at the time. As the deadline loomed ever closer, there was this sense of, well, of course at some point that this is all going to fall apart, and then they will be staring probably likely defeat in the next election in the face. And at that point, even though many people in Boris's own party just flat out do not trust him, and whether it's through their own personal dealings with him or just his very public track record of outright mendacity, they know that he is an election winner. He is their best shot to cling on to power. How? And so they will send for Boris. And, well, that is a good question, my friend. That is the thing that people have been asking with varying degrees of just bepuzzlement for decades now, because he's one of those figures who stands outside the usual political conventions, where there's this idea that political strategists and activists have of what the public wants to see in a leader. And usually that is someone who is very strong, but that strength gets conveyed through, well, they're very serious. And, you know, they you can imagine them being very stern and standing up to opponents from within and from outside, and they're able to convey that strength to the world. Boris Johnson he's the court jester, right? He's someone who gets caught in the middle of a scandal and just kind of ruffles his hair and stammers on and acts like, oh, well, you caught me with my hand in the cookie jar, and it's meant to be lovable. And somehow he gets away with it every single time. And he does seem to have this... there's this undeniable charisma and humor to his persona, but it seems like that should evaporate when serious issues are at play. And, you know, rarely are there more serious issues than this massive constitutional existential crisis for the UK, which he himself was involved in bringing about, and then also a global pandemic, which requires what you would think would be, you know, serious focused leadership. he's as far from that as you can imagine, and yet that seems to have embedded his popularity even further rather than denting it.
How much of Boris's appeal do you feel like is rooted in the British population almost like doing it for the memes, where because he is so, and I agree with you, kind of deliberately goofy, do you feel like just the fact that Boris Johnson being in charge at a time like this would be the most unbelievable and hilarious outcome we could have played a role in him ascending to power at a time like this?
I don't think it's so much doing it for the memes. I think it's more that not trying to be a normal political figure allows him to take this optimism, almost, that's very out of character for politics, where usually if you're trying to attack your political opponents or you're trying to present your own political vision, it tends to be either the country's going to the dogs, everything is terrible, look at all of these scandals that are happening, and so on and so forth, or it tends to be this is my vision for a brighter tomorrow, but in very hackneyed political terms that come across as quite inauthentic. For Boris Johnson, you know, in a lot of the ethnographic research that was done on specifically Labour voters who went Conservative for the first time to vote for Boris and his iteration of the Conservative Party, one reason they often gave was he makes us feel optimistic. You know, so much of politics is kind of doom and gloom, and, you know, justifiably so, you would say, in a lot of cases. But Boris makes us feel like actually there is hope, maybe we can work towards something brighter, as opposed to saying that but not appearing to live it out. And the fact that he seems to just avoid any consequences of his own actions, I think in some way confirms that, right? It's, you know, he seems to be indestructible, and maybe some of that will rub off on the country at large. And that's the thing which I think has always vexed his political opponents. It's, you know, when people who vote for Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party say, well, I like Boris because he sticks one up at the establishment. Well, Boris seems like as establishment a figure as you could possibly get. You know, this aristocrat who went to Eton, you know, a poshest school in the country, and then has kind of failed upwards into positions of power his entire career and never really been held accountable for any of it, never been held to any personal ethical standards. And I think in some ways that's kind of the point. It's he doesn't seem to take himself seriously, and so there's no way of kind of puncturing his pomposity because he doesn't seem to have one, even though, you know, God knows how he regards himself. But I think that does appeal to some people. They want someone who, you know, it might be more of a the enemy of my enemy is my friend situation rather than active enthusiasm for Boris. But it's easy to say, fuck it, let's give him a go, when you're not enthused about any of the other options, I guess.
I remember seeing on John Oliver, Dom, your boy, a clip of Boris giving some interview, I think long before he became prime minister, essentially talking about something that I actually am a big fan of in many aspects of life, more or less like balancing his range as a political figure, where it has been, at least as he would say, and I do think this kind of tracks based on what little I've seen from Boris, a deliberate effort to, even if he does know full well what he wants to say or wants to do, play it off like that may not necessarily be the case, because then when he is up there just completely flapping in the wind, people can't really tell the difference. They don't know if he is wholly unprepared or if this is all kind of a ruse there. Does that track with you as a British person who has seen, I would guess, a lot more of Boris than I have, or than most of the people hearing this right now, that he is far better suited than pretty much anyone else in the British political landscape to get away with having absolutely no idea what he's talking about, because people can say to themselves, well, surely he can't be this unprepared.
Definitely. Yeah, I think there's a case of you want reassurance under these circumstances, and so you want to believe that there must be some actual genius behind the bluster and the evasiveness and so on. Whereas the prospect that actually he's making it up as he goes along, just as he did whenever he was given a new opportunity in life, that is a terrifying prospect when this person is in charge of a pandemic response and everything else that goes along with it. I think also, you know, back in one of the previous conservative administrations, you know, after Margaret Thatcher was removed from office, her successor took over, there was this real sense of decay around that government that rose up over time. And there was this almost comically bad timing for them when, in an effort to get things going again and have a coherent identity, that Prime Minister John Major launched this Back to Basics campaign, you know, with a focus on this traditional morality and so on and so forth. And this was at the same time where that his government was being embroiled in sleaze and scandals left and right. You know, every day some new minister would be revealed as having an affair with their secretary or having embezzled public funds or some new thing that would be all over the front pages. And so the shamelessness and the hypocrisy of that really, really got to people. With Boris, he doesn't seem to hold himself to any standards, and he doesn't purport to either. And I think that's part of the essence of why he gets away with so much, is he's not pretending to be anything else. He's just out in the open about it.
Well, I think of absolutely no parallels over here in America that might fit that same description.
Well, the thing is, it's that trend of, I guess, right-wing populism, if you want to call it that, that's a trend that's been developing across the world over decades now. And even though a lot of it is coming into alignment at the same time, that doesn't mean that there's a direct, you know, either causal link or an easy connection between Donald Trump and any of the other figures that you want to name. And Boris actually has, I think, a lot more in common with maybe someone like a Silvio Berlusconi over in Italy, or a lot of these other demagogues of sorts. And if Trump's appeal is that he is this he is that Onion article of, you know, white hot ball of burning rage runs for GOP nomination, Boris is he doesn't come across as an angry person. He comes across as almost not angry enough when you want him to be, when he should be taking things seriously and taking a firm stance and standing up for you and for your country. He just he's kind of bumbling around. He is almost weirdly non-aggressive for someone who you want to be in a leadership position. And so even though you can draw the kind of lazy and obvious parallel, the actual appeal of their respective personalities to their core audiences, I think, is quite different.
Okay, and so along the way here, I feel like it was either March 31st or May 31st, and there was some deadline about we definitely have to make a decision by this point. I think this was back in the Theresa May days, and then that didn't happen and it got pushed to October 31st. How did we ultimately get from the point of Boris takes charge to the UK has Brexited?
So to go over an abridged timeline there, and if you want a fully detailed chronology of all of this, I will link one in the show notes, because yeah, if you want to go further in the details there. But Theresa May, as I said, when she called that election, before doing that, she triggered Article 50. And so that basically opened up this two-year time limit where it sets a date in the future on which that country will leave the EU, and you have the time before then to negotiate what that future relationship is going to look like. And so that was going to be initially scheduled for March 2019, which feels like eons ago now. And because of this deadlock that they simply couldn't move past, that deadline kept getting moved back and back and back. And so one farcical element of that was that if you are in the EU, every 5 years when the time comes along, you have to run elections for the European Parliament. And so you might think, well, why does the UK have to do that when it's about to leave the EU, assuming this all goes through? And the answer is, well, that's what EU law says, so that's what you're going to do. And so the thing that actually did in Theresa May in the end was the European elections, which in the past have been a very low turnout set of elections, which aren't really about Europe. They're mostly a chance for people to just vent their grievances about the government of the day, and you have the usual third parties or protest parties getting much higher votes than they would in any other electoral cycle. The Conservatives finished, I believe it was fifth in those elections with 9% of the vote, which is up there with the worst performances in a national election by an incumbent governing party ever, probably. And that the scale of that defeat is what really did for Theresa May. And it also reshaped the entire political landscape, because Nigel Farage, who a name you may not have heard in a while,
I haven't forgotten about Nigel.
he launched the Brexit Party to contest those elections, an outfit which didn't have all of the historical baggage that UKIP, his previous outfit, did. You had your disaffected Conservatives turning out. There was some poll where Conservative councillors, like 40% of them who were in office as Conservatives, were voting for the Brexit Party just on the pure basis of, we want Brexit to happen, so this is the way to express that will. So that really threw a spanner in the works of everyone's political assumptions. And so as we headed towards what seemed like deadlock and another general election down the line, there was this question of, well, is the Brexit Party going to be a large player in this new parliament? And then that in turn forces the Labour Party to twist itself into this position where no one's happy with their stance on Brexit. It just, everything went into chaos. And I am sure Nigel Farage was, giving his usual belly laugh and downing a pint at that one.
So was there much of a movement as all of this was failing to come together time after time for whatever it would be, another referendum or however it would work in England? I'm sorry for not knowing really the ins and outs.
Well,
or the broad strokes.
Don't apologize, because no one knew that this was uncharted territory that people were mapping out for themselves at the time. And the answer is yes. So what you saw in those in that set of elections was the Liberal Democrats, the kind of I don't know what the equivalent would be in the US, which has an even stronger two-party system than we do, but they are the kind of centrist-ish, more soft left, less kind of a socially conservative offshoot of the Labour Party. They adopted a hard Remain position. They wanted to revoke Article 50, cancel Brexit altogether. They went into those elections with the slogan "Bollocks to Brexit," as clear a stance of on Brexit as you could possibly get. There was a clear political space for people who, you know, the hardcore Remainers who were very unhappy with the Labour Party over its ambiguity and its waffling on Brexit. And as a response to that, the Labour Party then had to really clarify its own position, and they moved towards advocating for a second referendum, which, as I went into on one of the previous episodes, if you think that the first referendum was a bad idea, advocating for a second one just on the explicit basis that maybe this time we'll get the result that I want, it is a nakedly political move, which, firstly, there's no guarantee that you're going to win that referendum, right? And if you lose again, then God knows what you do next. But also, it's hard to dress that up as something other than it is. And it also, that move comes with the baggage of the EU having a history of member states having referendums on various treaties, rejecting those, and then their governments and the EU saying, well, no, wrong answer, run that back. And then as soon as they, you know, vote it through, it's not like best of three or anything. Like, that's just the law now, and we move forward with that. But as it became increasingly clear that this parliament was going nowhere on Brexit, then the case for a second referendum actually started to look more compelling, because if the only way out of this mess is to have a general election and get a new government, which is going to have to deal with everything about running the country for the next 5 years, including, you know, hypothetically, if there was a global pandemic next year, they would be in charge of responding to that. Then instead of bundling all of that up in this one vote as a response to Brexit, even though one of the issues with the referendum, the original one in the first place, was it was never going to be a narrow question of how do you feel about the EU. It was going to be if you want to stick your finger up for the Conservative Party, or if you hate the system as a whole, and one side can paint themselves as the anti-establishment and they can lock in your vote, even if you don't have the faintest clue what you think about the EU, you can never actually tell people the basis of what they're voting on. Instead of having a general election to answer that, why not just have the vote be about Europe and actually lance that boil once and for all? So even though the case for a second referendum, I think, was always kind of conceptually flawed, it became less and less so once every other option started to look like curdled milk as well.
I only ask because I believe the initial leave versus remain vote was extremely close, and there were a bunch of people afterwards who voted to leave that may have wanted to take back once they saw how things were actually going to play out and what kind of effect that was going to have. And I was curious if there was potentially an upswell, if that's a word, of support that may not have been there the first time around for actually wanting to remain. But
well, that's another issue with referendums or referenda as a whole, right? It's let's say you do have a narrow outcome on this kind of vote. In this case, it was 52-48. There's no half measure you can do there. Either you do this with everything that comes along with it, or you don't. And maybe the form of Brexit that you advocate is a softer one that you think would better reflect the wishes of the losing side. It accommodates part of that 48% as well as the 52%. You have this incredibly important national question on which there's this deep division down the middle, and there's no hope of like unity on that. This is, you know, I want option A, this other side wants option B. There's not really any way to meet in the middle there. When the margin is so narrow, there's no way that you can resolve that without those divisions getting even deeper and even more aggressive over time. What you can do, and this is the case in referendums in many countries, is you have a threshold that needs to be crossed for the referendum to go into effect. So let's say you need a 60-40 result in the vote. But even then, it would seem weird to say if, let's say, it's 57-43, well, that seems like a fairly conclusive margin, and yet we're not going to do it because you didn't cross this somewhat arbitrary-seeming number that we imposed in the hopes that it wouldn't get there and so that we would get to cancel the vote, right? So there's no way of handling that which actually looks responsible. And interestingly, over time, even after all of the craziness has happened, and we are now out of the EU, so I guess it's a question of rejoin rather than leave or remain, but the polling on do you want to leave or remain in the EU, and was it a mistake to vote to leave the EU, it's fluctuated, and usually remain or rejoin or it was a mistake has held a narrow lead. It's always been a very tight-run contest. It's always been roughly within a polling error of 52-48 in some direction or another. So the fundamentals have not really changed even after everything that's gone on. And so I think coming out of that first vote, the day after, you saw all those news bulletins of people saying to the cameras that they didn't know what they had voted for, and a lot was made out of that. Ultimately, though, it seemed like not many people really changed their position. And if anything, new political identities have formed and hardened around those divisions. It's not a case really anymore of Labour versus Conservative, or those class divisions which have been so deep in British society for so long. Those are still there, but now they often get reflected through the lens of, well, I'm a Leaver or I'm a Remainer, with all of the cultural attitudes and social status signaling and so on that goes with either of those positions.
So I believe I remember hearing you talk about the prospect of like a no deal Brexit, where, and please obviously correct whatever details I'm getting wrong here, I think the general idea was, we know we want to leave, we are definitely going to leave, but we don't really have a plan for what we're going to do once we've left. We just are out now. What ultimately came to be when the official Brexit finally went through? And what did they hit the October 31st, or when did this actually happen?
So the UK formally left the EU, on calling it Brexit Day, on the 31st of January 2020. And that kicked off this transition period that would last until the start of 2021. So it's only in the past few months that we have been out of the EU with a new arrangement in place. But that transition period, it's not like, okay, that the deal is finalized and now we're giving people time to adjust to it. It's we're out of the EU and there's a transition period, but we need that because we have no idea what's going on next. And it went really down to the 11th hour, to the point where you think back to June 2016 is when that referendum initially took place. And the UK leaves a transition period on effectively the 1st of January 2021. That's 4.5 years in which the government or governments, plural, and that's part of the issue there, had to decide what the future relationship between the UK and the EU is going to be. And instead, you had both businesses and people, whether it's EU citizens living in the UK or vice versa, in this period of tremendous uncertainty for years and years as all of this was being hashed out. And so you get in this absurd situation where with days left to go before the UK is out of the EU and under these new arrangements, businesses don't know what's going on. They don't know what new rules they will be operating under in a few days, which could be completely transformative, which could bankrupt or render their entire operation irrelevant. They don't know what's coming down the pipeline by and large. And so it's been strange to see the Conservatives, which traditionally have been able to market themselves as the party of business, you know, they are they're the ones standing up for capital against the socialists trying to snatch it away from them, and yet they have really lost the goodwill of much of the business community, and especially small businesses, over the past few years. I think the scales have dropped from a lot of their eyes, but for a lot of that time, the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, it was tough for a lot of people who are small business owners to kind of make the jump over to embracing that as well. So they found themselves kind of politically homeless, and that's a phrase that you will hear a lot of British people use to describe themselves as a way to kind of signal where their true home actually is or should be if someone filled that void.
Thinking through the number of different leaders that we have talked through, meaning prime ministers that we have talked through over the, I would say, relatively short amount of time that we've been covering British politics in any way, 3 prime ministers in 4 years seems like a lot. How long does the average prime minister serve?
So the expectations for this have been thrown a bit out of kilter, where in the past few decades, we have had several prime ministers who served very long terms. You know, Margaret Thatcher went for 11 years. Tony Blair went for close to 10 years. So the length of a party holding office and also of individual leaders holding office seems to have extended recently. The cadence of politics now is so much more fast-paced and chaotic, where in that period between 2014 and the present day, you've had the Scottish independence referendum, which was this big totemic event, and which we may get round two of that before too long. We had the 2015 general election, and then the Brexit vote, which then kicked off all of this ensuing drama. The 2017 general election, all of the stuff that led up to the 2019 general election, and now just recently there's COVID and everything else. So the rhythm of politics has really been thrown off in recent years, and it seems like now that Brexit has kind of been put on the sidelines as an issue, as we work our way out of the pandemic, politics is returning to more of a long-term activity. And you can see that many political commentators and politicians themselves are going to take some time to getting accustomed to that again, where this is a slow burn once more, where it seems unlikely that Boris Johnson will be turfed out before the next election.
So as things stand now, you are anticipating Boris, if we are back here talking about this, let's say 2 years from now, still being prime minister?
I think so, because frankly, his government was so shambolically bad in the handling of COVID, with so many moments that you think would, that like, this is the end, that this is when people will finally turn on them. Whether it's, I don't know if you heard this from across the pond, but, one of the senior advisors, Dominic Cummings, caught flouting some of the lockdown rules in the very first lockdown back this time last year. And then there was this education scandal, which if there's any group who like to make their complaints known, it is sharp-elbowed middle-class parents who saw the handling of their kids' exam results be just fiasco isn't even the word to describe it, but so many scandals like that, which you would think would doom most administrations or leaders by themselves, and Boris was able to just shrug it off and move on to the next thing. And so you end up and this is where the Trump thing might work its way in, where, like, if this isn't the thing that finally makes people stand up and take notice, then what is it going to be, right? And if that thing finally comes, it will seem like a surprise, because so many other accumulated scandals have failed to topple them. So why is this now the tipping point?
So we have the official exit on January 31st, 2020. And then, of course, COVID hits in, let's say, early March is when the government is forced to take some serious action, or at least strongly incentivized, I would imagine, to acknowledge this happening. But it sounds like Boris and company were not necessarily on top of the ball there. How did COVID impact the Brexit fallout?
I think it's basically impossible to disentangle the two as of when COVID hits in early 2020. So the first thing that immediately becomes apparent is, finally, some other stories in the news, where over the, you know, 3.5 years preceding that, between the referendum vote and COVID hitting, on any given day, it's pretty likely that Brexit itself or some Brexit adjacent story is going to be a top news item on any news bulletin front page across the land. And that sense of Brexit fatigue was real, and people were longing for anything else. And so, you know, COVID might be the monkey's paw response to that, the universe playing tricks there. And what we have seen is across the world, this bounce for incumbents who, even the ones who by any objective standards have made a complete mess of their COVID response, there is this sense of the pandemic almost rising above politics as an issue and being this national crisis that we all have to rally around. And usually under that almost kind of wartime scenario, that favors incumbents, so that they get a big boost from that. And we've seen that happen with COVID. How long that's going to be sustained for is unclear. It seems like that Brexit, or that COVID bounce, excuse me, is starting to erode. But at least there was something else there for the nation's attention to be focused on now. However, if you're someone working within the government, then this presents COVID by itself, regardless of anything else that's going on, is a tremendously difficult problem. But going into the Brexit vote, there was a camp of what you might call Eurosceptic Remainers, who they don't much like the EU, and in some cases they did like the EU to begin with. They believe in its mission statement, but after their own dealings with the EU, you know, working for governments or other organizations, they soured on it. But they didn't trust either this government or the institutions of the British state to handle the difficult task of leaving with any kind of responsibility. And I think that their outlook has aged depressingly well over time. And those same concerns apply to COVID, where if you don't have any faith in the kind of institutional capacity to handle any kind of crisis, well, now this is the biggest kind of crisis that a government can conceivably face, on top of this other thing which has been distracting their attention for so long now. And this is a government which, because it's been the same party has been in office for so long now, you would think what that means is, great, you have this wealth of experienced talent who you can send into those more important positions to try and get a handle on things. But instead, many of the people who had been in government have retired by now, they're at the end of their careers. Many of them were expelled from the party by Boris Johnson for failing to toe the line with regards to his Brexit deal. And so even if he had a sincere interest in assembling the best team to handle the these concurrent crises, he wouldn't be able to do that. And Boris himself is not the man for the moment. He's not the person you want giving this reassuring aura on the news bulletins every night, because he is just constitutionally incapable himself of actually doing that. So at a time when you need strong leadership more than ever, we have someone who has never claimed to be that, I guess, to his partial credit, and very clearly is not that, and could never be. And that's what made this such a terrifying prospect, on top of the pandemic itself being such a scare.
So was there a noticeable percentage of the British population, perhaps like Boris himself, and I don't know the answer to this, but was there a movement to like proudly not wear masks and declare that COVID is a hoax, the way that certainly swept over here in America?
Yeah, I think that movement is everywhere to a degree. It's certainly in Canada, where in Toronto there are very loud and very obnoxious anti-mask, anti-lockdown protests through the streets every weekend. But in the UK, I think part of that was neutered by the pedestal on which the country as a whole puts the NHS, where, and this has helped in the vaccine rollout itself too, where you see a level of vaccine skepticism kind of everywhere, but when it's coming from an organization that has the implicit trust and the goodwill of the country as a whole, it's easier for people who might be kicking up a fuss normally if they were living elsewhere to kind of fall in line. And so I think that kind of religious adherence to the NHS, in some cases, you know, in public policy terms, can be frustrating when it's hard to make improvements to the system or look at things that do need to be changed, because there's always an inherent backlash. But when it comes to getting people to rally around the health system in a crisis, that's exactly the kind of automatic buy-in that you need.
And was Nigel Farage perhaps one of the people not wanting to comply with COVID protocols?
So after the Brexit Party disappeared, because what was the point of it anymore, his Act 3, if you like, or Act whatever it is now, was going to be the Reform Party, which, you know, very generic name. Trump actually ran under the Reform Party ticket in the US back in 2000, as you'll recall. But so that was meant to be an anti-lockdown outfit, I think, but it never really got off the ground. And I think he is not fully retired yet, but he has struggled to find a place back in public life. But there is a vocal lockdown skeptic movement, COVID skeptic movement. And as the UK vaccine rollout is going so well, neutered a lot of that, what would have been a more ferocious lockdown skepticism, because the light is more clearly at the end of the tunnel. You know, the tunnel is shorter and the light is brighter.
And with COVID and vaccine rollouts at least looking optimistic as things stand right now, is Brexit coming back into the limelight for Boris and company? And does it seem like they are at this point beginning to be prepared for what comes next along these lines?
I think for now, Brexit has mostly been neutered as a political issue. And part of that is that COVID and Brexit are masking the impact of each other, where I think after COVID there will be a prolonged economic slump, because it seems like we were just about due for one of those anyway, and if we weren't, then COVID may have changed that and brought one with it. And so let's say Brexit goes badly, some of those Brexit-related consequences will be put down to either COVID itself or that just general economic downturn. It might be hard to isolate Brexit as the primary cause of those. Alternatively, there's a world where Brexit goes better than expected, but the economy is in a slump anyway because of this other stuff that's going on. And so it might be hard to point to some kind of benefit from the version of Brexit that you were advocating for. So it's hard to disentangle those two things. And I think as well, when the Brexit vote came in and we knew that this was going to happen, for the people who saw this as a catastrophe, I think they split into a few different camps over exactly how that might reveal itself. So for some, it was people are going to wake up one day and suddenly, you know, the shelves will be bare and the medicine cabinets will be empty and there will be massive pileups of traffic for miles along the south coast, and we'll be in this kind of pre-apocalyptic maybe scenario suddenly overnight. And There was another camp saying that, if anything, Brexit is more of a medium-term to long-term gradual decline across the board, where it's going to be hard to identify, oh, this is a thing which has been ruined because of Brexit, but it's more of a unnecessary pain and kind of decrease in economic performance or quality of life spread out over time. And I think the second camp is, if they are right about its impact, are more correct about how that's going to present itself. You know, that overnight catastrophe has not really happened yet. The issue there, though, is that that is happening, but it's happening in very narrow pockets of the country as a whole. So, for example, the way this deal was hastily constructed together at the 11th hour, it's very open-ended, very unclear about a lot of things. And so there are kind of unnecessary omissions where, even under what it is by all accounts a fairly hard Brexit, there are things which you could have taken care of and which could have functioned mostly as they did before, but which now are completely thrown into uncertainty. So one example that came up was many kind of musical companies, theatre companies are cancelling their plans for European tours and performances because the rules that were in place before, allowing them to, for example, go for temporary work in several different countries in sequence, which is legally a minefield if you don't have the paperwork in place. And then, let's say you're a musician, maybe, or a theatre company, maybe you have to transport your instruments or your set or other equipment, and that can be very expensive and logistically difficult as well. Those industries are now suffering greatly because the basic diligence and care that needed to address those their concerns has not been put in. And so there are some areas where inherently it's a zero-sum game and there was competition. So one issue that came up throughout the campaign and since was the role of the City of London in terms of Britain's financial services prowess, where it's, you know, one of the leading financial centres in the world. If we leave the EU, how is that going to change? Because there are many places like Frankfurt in the EU where you could see a lot of that business moving instead. That's a case of direct competing interests, right? Whereas things like a theatre company not being able to tour because for some reason the rules that could still be in place that allow them to actually move their equipment, move their people, get all this together, those just aren't there. No one has an interest in them not being able to work. You know, there's no French theatre company looking to sabotage a competition. There's no
there might be France, you never know.
Maybe there is. They're a wily bunch, but there's no interest for any actors in the, well, I say actors, agents, let's say, in the UK to not have that be possible either. It's just a case of unnecessary pain. And so if you are, let's say, working in the theatre industry and you're seeing yourself being crushed by this for no good reason, then of course you're going to have a lot of anger towards the people who inflicted that upon you. But how is that going to translate into a wider political grievance or awareness? Because, you know, voters, you know, swing voters in marginal seats are not going to say, oh, well, those theatre guys really got screwed over by that, so I guess we're going to vote Labour this time. It's hard to mobilise that into a political issue. And if it was just one example of, let's say, the arts, then that would be one thing. But this is being repeated across the board in so many different industries where life is just unnecessarily harder for no reason, and yet it's hard for all of those different strands to kind of tie up and become this yarn that becomes a bigger issue.
And I would imagine, again, that COVID has really muddied the waters in terms of allowing people to differentiate between how things would look if we had just Brexited and not had global pandemics versus having to deal with that sort of thing that they could, at least certain people could pretty easily spin as directly just a result of COVID and, oh, it wouldn't be this big of a deal and Brexiting was fine and so forth, in situations where that may not necessarily be the case. And I'm guessing, as you alluded to, tourism, specifically with London, is having some pretty major negative effects as a result of COVID. But just in general, I am curious about now that the UK is out of the EU, what the future looks like as far as crossing borders within Europe, which used to be an extremely easy thing to do for countries within the EU, and in particular, what has become of the border with Ireland? Because I don't know what I hesitate to use the word solution that has been implemented is, but I definitely know that was a big cause for concern in the first place.
Yeah, the border question is a really fascinating one, because the principle of free movement in the EU has always been completely sacrosanct. And this is where David Cameron, when he was going through this very kind of confected renegotiation of Britain's role in the EU, this is where he ran up against a brick wall, because he was assuming he could get much stronger concessions on freedom of movement than were ever really on the table. He didn't understand that this was the absolute red line, especially for the countries whose freedom of movement was most at issue in terms of political uproar over immigration. They were never going to countenance any pushback on that. So this is a core and guiding principle of the EU. And suddenly we found ourselves over the past year in a situation where it's not a question of you can go and live and work in 27 different EU countries, as you probably have been cooped up in your region, in your one country for the past year, no matter if you have wanted to be or not. That principle of freedom of movement is still in place from a legal perspective, although regional lockdowns, national lockdowns have made that a thorny issue as well. But in practice, that freedom has been removed. And so I think the effect of that has been, it's kind of been double-edged. It's been to show what a world without that looks like. And so if that's a world that you want, I mean, you have something that you can point to now. But I think it has also driven home the importance of that to many people. It has reaffirmed their belief in that fundamental commitment. And so I think issues of certainly immigration and borders within the EU will take on a new tone post-COVID. What that new tone will look like is obviously hard to predict and quite circumstantial. But I do think we will see a kind of post-COVID discourse on all of those things. And on the issue of Ireland, this is the main point of differentiation between Theresa May's proposed deal and Boris Johnson's eventual deal. And this is what should be maybe the core issue at the heart of the Brexit discussion. And ever since Brexit was seriously on the table, there's been this issue of, if you want to remove the UK from the single market and the customs union, you have an issue with Ireland. Because if Northern Ireland is with the rest of the UK and the Republic of Ireland is still in the EU, then you have this question, just as you would if you were driving goods across the Channel Tunnel from the UK to France, of, well, there's a border here between an EU country and a non-EU country where all of these different rules apply regarding what goods can be brought in, who can travel, under what circumstances, and so on and so forth. And if it was just that border between the UK and France, that would already be a tricky thing in itself. But the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland is an incredibly fraught issue. Just geopolitically, going back actually 100 years now and more. So if you don't have a clear answer to that question, then you don't really get to argue for a harder Brexit that removes the UK from those arrangements, unless you have a very good reason. And that aspect was never really driven home very hard at all, either during the campaign itself or in the closer 4.5 years since then. And it's been a recurring and understandable sore spot for people in both the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, that so much of the Brexit process, even though they are one of the main issues at its heart, has just kind of ignored them. And that most commentary on Brexit in the UK downplays this issue or ignores it altogether, and that even figures who seem pretty up to speed and engaged with the Brexit process seem to have a fundamental misunderstanding of issues when it comes to Ireland. And so if you now make that border a place where all of these checks have to be done and where there are opportunities for people who on both sides of that old conflict who want to reignite violence to cause trouble, then you're basically taking this wound, which is healing very slowly and very uneasily, and where that peace settlement has only been in place for a few decades now, and it's always just at the edge of coming apart at the seams. You're taking that wound and you're just ripping it open again and hoping that it's going to be okay.
Well, quickly, sorry, but one person who definitely did acknowledge that, and I will admit that I did not go back and listen to our old podcast to prepare for this, allegedly, like, to get myself in the mentality of the ignorant American who hasn't been paying attention to any of this, so I could ask the questions that the people listening would be wanting asked, more accurately, mostly just out of laziness, but I did go back and watch the John Oliver segments covering Brexit in real time, and that is an issue they definitely flagged up, and they rolled a clip of someone being asked about that on British news, and the answer the guy gave was, oh, there's going to be a massive amount of violence, 100%, if there's some sort of hard border.
And this is the unintended consequence of every American wanting to believe that they're a quarter Irish, is that there's almost a more informed discourse around this issue in the US and there was in many parts of the UK over the past 5 years or so.
Well, how much of that was just not wanting to think about it because it was obviously going to be a huge issue?
That's the thing. It becomes an issue once you put those different border arrangements in place, and that's a result of taking the UK out of the single market, out of the customs union. So that's essentially the difference between a soft Brexit and a hard one. And Theresa May got herself in this Gordian knot very early on because she committed herself publicly and committed her government to that was a firm line for her. We were leaving the single market, leaving the customs union. We were pursuing a Brexit that would be, if not rock hard, at least somewhat solid. And so once you commit to that, the obvious next follow-up question is, okay, what is your response to the issues in Ireland? And she then... It wasn't like she hadn't thought of it, but it was, oh, I guess you're right. And then the next year and a half, and really the rest of her premiership, was coming up with a fudge of sorts to try and answer that question via the backstop, which I've heard described on its own terms as actually a pretty smart... It's effectively a good answer to a bad problem that you've made for yourself, effectively, where... You shouldn't need to get in this situation where the backstop is the best answer to that question. But it was, and yet that solution was never going to fly across the board. And so after she handicaps herself by effectively throwing this election through self-sabotage, then she cannot afford to have a part of her deal which does not go down well with a vast swathe of people in Parliament. And so maybe if she were the ruler of all she surveys and she had this stonking great majority, she could get away with that. And we would currently be living under Brexit via the May deal, where the backstop maybe would be serving its intended purpose. Instead, that was the issue that doomed her, because you need an answer to that question, but the backstop was not a politically palatable one, and so it was dead on arrival. There was no way that was ever getting through. And so... Boris Johnson comes in, and his solution is that other red line that Theresa May drew of no British Prime Minister could consider putting that border down the Irish Sea between the mainland of the UK and the island of Ireland itself. That was a red line for her, and would have been a red line for basically any other British Prime Minister who was more attentive to its potential consequences. Boris Johnson was like, okay, well, that seems like an easy fix. And so that was his solution. And that's what we see now, is there are border checks in the Irish Sea. And those issues are flaming up again in Ireland. And it's not directly a consequence of Brexit. It's not like, because of this, therefore X, Y, and Z are happening. But there has been massively increased violence in Ireland recently, which has received much less attention than it would merit by most media back in the mainland UK. And I don't mean that in the conspiratorial sense of, oh, look at what the media is covering up. They just don't really seem to be acknowledging it or interested in it or engaged in any way. And it's a reflection of how little attention or understanding there is of Ireland within this process. And that has been, you know, if you've been a politician in the UK in, let's say, the 90s or the 2000s, and your brief did not involve Ireland directly, you could get away with not needing to know much about it or take stances on these issues. However, it being so deeply bound up in the larger Brexit question means if you're involved in the Brexit debate, which is impossible not to be if you're a politician, then you implicitly or explicitly, you are taking a stance on this question. And so it behooves you to study up on it.
It sounds like, at least because they're happening concurrently, the coming up with a plan long term for resolving this whole Brexit issue, to frame it in weird terms, alongside everything going on with COVID, is potentially buying some time for the Borises and whoever else to delay necessarily having to come up with concrete plans, because there are so many fiascos going on simultaneously that who on earth could expect all of this to be going smoothly right now? How long do you feel like this can remain sustainable before the UK population, and again, I know it's very difficult to speak on the population at large as if they all have just one unilateral thought, but if it, I guess the way to frame it is, if it continues being more or less like an unmitigated disaster with no real plan in mind for another couple of years, assuming, and this may be a bad assumption, but assuming 2 years from now, COVID is hopefully a thing of the past. If we are still in this state where the Ireland and Northern Ireland border is a complete fiasco and there are no really clear plans as far as all of the other concerns that people have right now pertaining to Brexit, is it possible that there will be a movement to like rejoin the EU?
I think that's somewhat unlikely, because for many people, including many who voted to remain or who supported remain at the time, you know, Boris did get Brexit done, and they might not pat him on the back for that. They might not vote for him as a result. It may not be the form of Brexit that they wanted, but for them, Brexit has been effectively deactivated as a political issue. And so, you know, the Labour Party has, you know, the main opposition through whom any electoral movement to rejoin would have to run. They have accepted, we are out, we are not going to try to rejoin. And one thing that almost accidentally neutered in advance any movement to rejoin is, because this deal was thrown together at the last minute, there is a lot of open-endedness to it, a lot of flexibility over stuff that they just didn't really get round to deciding or coming up with a good answer to. And as a result, it is much easier if you are an opposition party to say, okay, put us in office and we will improve on this Brexit deal. We will fix X, Y, and Z, and we'll add it, we'll sweeten the deal by doing this, and we will stand up harder if the EU tries to take this part away. It is much easier to fight over the terms of the existing deal, because then you can't be portrayed as trying to kind of relitigate Brexit or to focus on Brexit instead of focusing on more important things. It's much safer to say, why don't we just do this but do it better? In general, the result was accepted by most people, even if it wasn't the one they wanted. So if you go on Twitter, then the most vocal people participating in the Brexit discussion will be either hardcore Remainers for whom any Brexit would be a betrayal and who are now fully in the rejoin camp, or the kind of very angry Brexiteers for whom any movement away from their ideal Brexit is a betrayal, and you know, Boris is always veering dangerously close to being a traitor if he puts a foot out of line, and who enjoy kind of continuing the culture war on, but on that new front. But for the most part, the vast majority who voted or didn't vote because they weren't engaged with the issue at the time in the 2016 referendum have accepted the need for Brexit because that's the result that won, and they don't see a need to relitigate that.
Okay, so I guess, and again, it's very difficult to have a clear answer on this. I'm just wondering how bad this needs to get for what percentage of the population to want to go back on this. Well, but I'm sure that's...
The other thing, too, is it's not a case of do we go back to exactly what we had before or do we stay under this new deal? It's do we try to join the EU again? And that would be done from first principles, but with the additional baggage or lingering animosity that might come from having gone through the Brexit process to begin with. So you would be starting from a worse position than some random country, like let's say an independent Scotland, who was hoping to join themselves for the first time. And that would...
But surely there's some line where that's a superior alternative to what could potentially be the situation in a couple of years.
Hypothetically, like if it in at the absolute bottom of its range, sure. But it's going to be, even then, I think it would be hard to guide the political debate in that direction. And if we did make an application to rejoin, firstly, there would be a desire in some quarters to make that as punishing as possible to kind of dissuade any movement towards some other prefix then exit in the future, you know, some other country going the same way. But then also there are questions like
Frexit.
Frexit was never on the table, but you know, there are some other portmanteaus we could work in there. But any country wanting to join the EU has to grapple with questions like, for example, are you going to be part of the euro? And you would better be if you're going to join the EU. And the UK has always held out on that, has always been able to remain outside the eurozone. I don't know if that would be the case if the UK were trying to join as what would still be one of the EU's largest economies were it to come back in as a non-eurozone member. And that has been a highly politically charged issue in the UK when it seemed like there was a prospect of joining back in the late 90s and early 2000s. And
forgive me for go ahead. I was going to say, forgive me for being such a pessimist potentially here. It just has seemed to me from an American perspective, like the UK has pretty consistently been finding the bottom of its range. You've been showing up with the bottom of its range here. And so I do think those are timelines worth considering.
So I think it's different when it's remain versus leave, and remain is the status quo option. That's what it means to remain versus leave, where at that point, it's easy to ask any leave advocate, okay, so why do we make this change and how do we make this change and what are the effects of that going to be, versus let's say we get 10 or 15 years down the line and being outside the EU is the status quo option, which is where we are at the moment, and going into the EU is the hypothetical scenario that has all of these complicated logistical questions to answer afresh.
So I guess let me ask you this. If we think back to the first time that we podcasted about this in June 2016, and you had a crystal ball and you could see how everything would play out from there to the point that we currently are, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would 1 being the lowest and 10 being a perfect 10, how would you evaluate the way that this has gone?
I think it's coming in maybe like a 3.5 out of 10. It's tough to visualize what the actual bottom of that range looks like, because it's kind of too weird to think about. But I would mostly be, if I also saw the timeline leading up to all of that, I would be shocked by how Theresa May seemed determined to play the game on hard mode, so to speak. Just, and once you decide to play the game on hard mode, you need to actually show up and do well at the game, which she also failed to do. So she picked a fight that she was poorly suited for and predictably lost it. Looking back over this whole process, going, you know, anticipating the referendum and then the result that surprised me at the time, and then going forward, if I compare what I expected to happen versus what did happen, I mean, I thought Remain would win, first of all, and would win pretty comfortably. And I think that was the consensus opinion among people who were following the referendum. Once it was decided the Brexit was going to happen, I thought a softer Brexit, even if you're being purely calculating about it, so taking any issue of ideology or what you want to happen out of the equation, it seemed to make much more sense for the main actors involved to pursue a softer Brexit, because you had, firstly, retaining most of that framework but replicating it outside the EU is much easier and would get much more cooperation and buy-in from the EU than kind of picking this fight in order to differentiate yourself as much as possible from the outside and have to construct this whole new arrangement. All of the figures within, you know, business and the establishment and the media and politics and so on who were lined up behind Remain, you know, the majority of establishment figures at that point, having them on board would make the entire process a lot easier. And once the result was in, most of them would have fallen in behind a softer Brexit rather than a harder one. And then when you look at the public at large, I think there's this assumption, and maybe it's more true than I want to believe, that the most hardcore Brexit advocates, the people who really wanted to leave and once that was locked in would accept no compromise over how hard the Brexit was, they were never going to be a reliable constituency unless you are like actually at that end of the spectrum. If you're Nigel Farage or UKIP or the Brexit Party or whatever option they were presented with, they were always going to gravitate over there. At the other end, the people who were Remainers and who are now Rejoiners and who are still agitated over Brexit, for them, you know, if you are Theresa May, if you're the Conservative Party, they're never voting for you anyway, right? They're going to see you as the people leading this national betrayal, this act of ruin. And so their votes are mostly a lost cause. But that broad swathe of people in the middle, whether it's the people who voted to leave but don't really have a strong view or preference over how that should be done, or the people who voted Remain but who now think the result needs to be respected, but why don't we try and at least stick with most of what we have now, they would be more on board for a soft Brexit. So for Theresa May at the time, it seemed like it would be so much easier from every angle to pursue a softer Brexit rather than a harder one, and yet she tacked in exactly the opposite direction and predictably ended up shipwrecked on the rocks. That being said, looking at where Boris Johnson has taken the party now, with a crushing election victory, big majority, he's realigned British politics. We now have the electoral base of the Conservative Party is new, and the entire political geography has been upended, perhaps permanently. It's tough to say that it hasn't worked out well for the Conservative Party, but I think that's just a testament to how adaptable the party has been over time and how it mostly just will do whatever it needs to do to hold on to power for the most part. Whereas if I was an agent in that process, if I was the prime minister trying to bolster my own survival and also get, you know, the best outcome for Brexit at large, it seems like Theresa May kind of really just made life impossibly difficult for herself for no good reason.
So we, again, have done a couple of podcasts over the years about this, and since then, the topic of Brexit has intermittently come up in passing when talking about Survivor or whatever else, and I have gotten the vibe that along the way, you have not felt particularly great about the direction that things have been heading. It's, you know, oh, we missed another deadline. Oh, no real solution to this problem. We're not really trying to think too much about this right now. You yourself ended up Brexiting England a couple of years ago or so at this point. Setting aside what made political sense for Theresa May or Boris Johnson or whoever else, and setting aside the UK population at large, if we were to just wind back the clock and go back to 2016 and you somehow had full knowledge of exactly how this would end up playing out, would you continue to vote leave in 2016 being fully results oriented, or would you want to just remain in the EU?
If I have that crystal ball?
Correct.
Given that crystal ball, I would vote for Remain, because to use actually my personal Brexit thing to Canada as an analogy there, you know, if I told you before then, and I'm sure I did at one point, oh, hey, I'm going to move to Canada, I think you would say, oh, that's really cool, I'm excited for you, what do you plan to do? And if my response was, oh, I don't know where I'm going to live, I don't know what I'm going to do for money, I actually don't know legally how that's even possible, but I'm just going to move, okay? I'll figure it out when I get there. You understandably would have some concerns, I think. And you would say, even though I would like you to make a new life in Canada if that's what you want, maybe this isn't such a good idea. And so, yeah, but for me, it was never an unconditional, we need to Brexit at all costs because of X, Y, and Z. It's, I think, if this is executed, and I don't think the bar is even that high, actually. I think it's inherently a complicated thing. They made it massively more complicated in a way that they themselves were not well equipped to handle. But I think they could have stuck the landing if there was a baseline level of attention and competence being paid to it. I think they could have stuck the landing in a way that I think would have achieved the goals I wanted at the time and would leave us in a better place going forward. And they just did not do that.
I vividly recall.
And I think, don't want to cut you off if this was not what you were getting at, but I think the response would be, okay, well, looking at who would plausibly be entrusted to handle that process, you know, surely you either could or could not have confidence in whoever it was. And that's true. And, you know, I was no fan of David Cameron, was no fan of Theresa May. So it didn't seem like any of the plausible candidates were up my alley, you know, leaving my own ideology aside even. But that was the one opportunity you were going to get, right? It's not like you can mulligan on this now, and in 10 years, under people who you trust more, we can reactivate this issue and go for it again. So this is the issue with referendums, fundamentally. It's, you are taking a snapshot of public opinion under all of these different circumstances and conditions and interpreting that the way you want it to. And that leave vote, that 52-48 margin, both the 52 and the 48 have no broad base of agreement over what that means to them or what the eventual end state is meant to be. And yet they get interpreted as this binary of it's A or it's B, and so we have to do one of these two things. And that's not a sound basis on which to run public policy, you know? And that's why even I remember as the referendum was being announced, you know, years prior, there was a quote from Margaret Thatcher that would get thrown back in David Cameron's face about how referendums are just a fundamentally flawed idea that no self-respecting prime minister would ever sign up to. And you can find those quotes from many figures across the political spectrum, because this is the difficulty that you sign up to.
What I was going to say, yeah, is I vividly remember saying, like, I don't know anything about British politics, and obviously you know a lot. You were living in England at that point for your entire life, and I do not have any kind of like clear talking points to refute any of this. The one thing I do know is pretty much everyone smart seems to think that this is going to be an absolute disaster if it goes through. And what definitely stands out in my memory is you saying, like, this is the one chance we're going to have at this. And I don't know that the EU necessarily has the UK's best interest at heart, and it's now or never. And I did question at the time the wisdom of, like, yeah, if this is our one chance, that still doesn't necessarily make it a great plan. I don't know that it necessarily tracks that because we can do this and we're not going to be able to do it in the future, we definitely should be doing this.
Yeah, it's a good tie-in to the final kind of cluster of points that I wanted to get onto, because that association of progressives, and especially young progressives, with being pro-EU, that has not always been the case. And it used to be the other way, where in the 80s, it was the Conservatives under Margaret Thatcher who were the most full-throttle supporters of the EU, along with what would later become the Eurosceptic Tory press. And it was the Labour Party under the kind of old left faction that Jeremy Corbyn was a part of, who took this firm anti-EU stance because they saw it as this kind of corporatist club that would only benefit its own members and would kind of stymie any domestic or international efforts at class consciousness, I suppose. And then that shift, where both sides kind of reversed their positions, took place in the late 80s, where by that time, the Conservatives had been in power for close to a decade. The Labour Party was in complete disarray. And so if you were a young progressive at the time, it seemed like there was no hope of containing the Conservatives domestically, but the EU maybe was this this kind of beacon abroad where it was placing an increased focus on securing workers' rights through legislation that would apply to all of its member states. And it seemed like your goals could not really be accomplished under this very conservative domestic political system, but maybe the EU was a way of addressing that and kind of reining that in, keeping it in balance. So conversely, as that was happening, you saw this Eurosceptic wing in the Conservative Party then start to say, well, the EU is this this overweening state which is trying to control us, which doesn't have accountability domestically, doesn't have the same claim to sovereignty. And so those positions were flipped on their heads. So this, the kind of instinctive identification of, well, my politics generally lean over here, therefore I'm pro-EU in general or pro-Remain versus Leave or versus being Eurosceptic, that has always been a contingent and somewhat recent thing. So that's a point to keep in mind, first of all. But over the past few years, you've seen the Brexit process itself evolve. You've also seen how the EU tries to handle new developments and new crises. And yeah, I don't have any more love for the EU than I did a few years ago. And if anything, I think it really has not distinguished itself over the past few years. And COVID has been really this testing ground for a lot of assumptions that people make about which countries and which leaders and so on you want to emulate and who you look up to, where for a long time, many people on the kind of center-left, I guess you would say, saw the Scandinavian countries as the kind of model that we want to follow, right? The Nordic countries have figured out social democracy and any movement towards that can align ourselves with them will get us to a better place. But those countries have not had a good crisis when it comes to COVID. Similarly, when you have been living under...
Oh, they haven't had a good crisis, unlike all the other countries that have good crises?
Well, that's the thing. It's not easy to have a good crisis, but they have not. You know, even if you think their politics in general is more enlightened or in a more stable place, that has not converted into better action responding to the biggest issue of the time. Likewise, when you are living under Prime Minister Boris Johnson, it is very tempting to look abroad at some foreign leaders and think, oh God, if only, right? Like Angela Merkel is often held up as the perfect contrast to the Berlusconis or Trumps or Boris Johnsons of the world, where they're these blustering male demagogues and she's this pragmatic, smart woman who gets a job done, who's non-ideological. She just, she's the national leadership figure. And yet Germany has also fumbled the ball massively in terms of its response to COVID, just like everywhere else. So I get the impulse that went into that shift, certainly in the late 80s, and now as we enter the 11th consecutive year of Conservative government again, to look to the grass on the other side, to look across our shores and think, I wish we could be more like them. But one thing that COVID, one way in which it has been so disillusioning is that it's really hard to find what that other example is meant to be anymore, where there's no consistent model for which leaders or which countries which political systems or sympathies have handled this crisis better, it's been just completely shambolic across the board. And the EU itself, the one idea for that kind of transnational institution is that it's able to be this crucible where, even though domestically it's hard to get a grip on these situations, working together we can be more than the sum of our parts. But the EU response to COVID itself has also been either lacking in your public health terms, or to, in some cases, outright damaging and misleading, as we're seeing with the vaccine rollout, where not only are they lagging massively behind most other places, the UK famously now and the US, but also they are, their agencies are getting themselves into trouble over mischaracterizing the risks posed by various vaccines and then delaying rollouts accordingly and wrecking public confidence in those vaccines. So then that in turn makes those vaccine rollouts take a lot longer. So the idea that, well, we in the UK are uniquely bad, or we're uniquely ignorant, this kind of reverse British exceptionalism that is tempting for a lot of people to subscribe to, very easy to be pessimistic about the direction the UK is going. But under COVID, it's been very difficult to look across our shores and think, oh, well, I really wish I was in this country instead. Because even the countries that have nailed some part of this, so yeah, the UK has had a good vaccine rollout, its handling of COVID before then was incredibly shameful. It was absolutely terrible. Same thing with the US, right? That kind of faith in institutions or faith in a particular belief about how politics should be run or what kind of leaders we need to get the best outcomes, all of that has, or at least should be, thrown into question by what's happening with COVID. And if your belief system has not been challenged in some way by the past year, then I think that's on you more than that's an indication that you are missing the forest for the trees, I think, and not that you actually uniquely have stumbled across the answers to everything, and that if only we listened to you, then the world would be in a better place. So that spirit of either intellectual humility or just outright despair, I think, is the sensible response to those events. One final thing about the how COVID has impacted Brexit is, leading up to Brexit Day, if you're Boris Johnson, if you're the government, you really want this this win that you can point to as an example of why Brexit needed to happen. Because this is the tension at the heart of that trade-off, is if you have a soft Brexit where you mostly have the same arrangements that you had before, then some people would ask, well, why did we need to go to all this trouble in the first place? But if you have a hard Brexit, then you want to have something to show for it, because you've gone through even more, and you want to have a W on the board that maybe by itself does not come close to making it worthwhile, but it's a start, and it's a model for what you can expect going forward. But it's really hard to come up with that, because even if the argument is, well, now that we're this independent, buccaneering, swashbuckling nation again, and you hear these maritime pirate metaphors constantly, then we can go out there and we can strike our own trade deals with the rest of the world, which is something that you can't do if you're locked into the EU's framework. Then the issue there becomes, well, even the simplest trade deals take many years to negotiate and to finalize, and often are not free of conflict themselves. And even when those are in place, the benefits of them are not immediately obvious. You know, if you're buying groceries and your carrots are 20p cheaper than they were last week, no one's going to point to that and say, oh, that's a result of this trade deal that we just signed with Peru. So great. Good job, Boris. Yeah. And I'm going to vote for Boris now. There's no clear causal link between the steps in that process. The benefits of trade take a long time to materialize. And then when they do, it's hard to see who they actually materialize for in a politically exploitable way. And so with that in mind, when you don't even know what your own Brexit is going to look like days before it's due to become law, really hard to, on Brexit Day, point to something and say, this is why we had to Brexit, until the vaccine news comes along at the perfect time for this to become an issue, because the preparations that the UK had been able to make outside the EU, and yes, technically countries in the EU can chart their own course on this, but the UK was heavily, was at the center of the European Medicines Agency. And so it couldn't really break from the party line. The UK being able to do its own thing there had this direct material benefit that Boris could then point to and say, look, we would not have been able to do this otherwise, regardless of how exactly true that would have been. And that argument, I think, has struck a chord with people. Like, this is the W that you point to as the first example of how, hey, if we get in another crisis like this, then it's really important that we can not be locked into the mistakes of the EU, the unforced errors that the EU is making time and time again on this issue.
And one final question from me, at least off the top of my head. I have, over the years, certainly asked random things about the royal family, and I believe, generally speaking, at least the Queen tends to play it down the middle, may even be overstating it, like largely stay apolitical. Have any members of the royal family, like, spoken out one way or the other about their satisfaction or lack thereof with leaving?
Not any major royals, as far as I can tell. Maybe some of the third cousins, who I'm sure are having it off with the first cousins or whatever. Maybe they have, taken their place in the political spotlight. But the Queen became this accidental political football during the run-up to the Brexit referendum, because you had David Cameron strongly suggesting that the Queen had supported Remain, and then other people saying, well, look at the bare demographics here. She is a rich, old white lady. Probably she's going to vote to leave. That's, you know, we have the data on this. And after, yeah, as the Brexit negotiations were going so pear-shaped, so much was made of the symbolism of the Queen's clothing choices and even, like, hat choices, hairpin choices while out in public, where, oh, look, she wore this outfit which has the same shade of blue as the EU flag, and, oh, that could be interpreted as one of the stars on the EU flag. So, and God knows what she herself was making of all of this discussion, if she was even aware of it. And if she were, as the Queen, as a consummate professional, you would not be aware of that yourself. I'm sure she raised an eyebrow and gave it a wry grin from within the safe confines of Buckingham Palace. The kind of culture war behind Brexit is so all-consuming that even the figure who is meant to rise above the fray more than anybody else, and who that is literally her constitutional role, is to be impartial and to be above this, even she gets roped into this against her own volition.
Dom, what else did you want to get into, if anything, as far as Brexit in early, we will still say, 2021 is concerned?
I guess one thing to look ahead to is, as we emerge from COVID into what could sadly be the post-COVID slump, seeing how the EU responds to that is going to be quite interesting, I think. And this doesn't apply to Britain itself, because, you know, we are a larger economy that was outside the Eurozone, so this next bit doesn't really apply. But if you are a smaller country in the Eurozone, then what you're going to find is, you know, you might be in a state of deep economic crisis. You might think that you need to take some kind of radical steps to get yourself out of it. Your capacity to do that is very heavily limited, because you have no control over monetary policy, because you're in the Eurozone, the ECB and the more influential European countries will have more to say on that. And then in terms of fiscal policy, Eurozone membership also places heavy constraints on what you can do with that as well. So the one thing that the EU does, and this is true of any kind of a larger national or transnational institution, is it limits the scope for any kind of unilateral radical action, which in many cases can be a good thing, and often that is the point of those institutions. But it does have consequences for domestic politics too, where what you see is, in some of these countries that find themselves in terrible situations, there's no way of resolving that through the usual democratic process, because you might vote for, you know, a party that's further to the left, further to the right, a party that promises radical new solutions, but those solutions can only be so radical insofar as they fit within the narrow framework that you're allowed by the Eurozone, that straitjacket that you're in. And so unless you take the incredibly radical step of wanting to leave the Euro or leave the EU, which is really not on the table basically anywhere in the EU at the moment, then your options are much more limited. And so if you're a politician in that system, then maybe that has some benefits. If you're a voter in that system, then it can be really hard to find the party that actually lets you protest against that. And that's why I think you might see a rise in kind of extremist parties on whatever end of the political compass during that time, because the capacity for that kind of political response is so much more limited.
All right. Well, I have certainly learned quite a bit here today. Thank you for walking me through what has been going on over there for the last couple of years at this point, and all the best to the people in England, although I myself still remain somewhat nervous about all of this eventually going smoothly, but we will certainly see, and potentially, Dom, be back in here later on with some sort of update.
This is where, sorry to cut you off, but this is why it's easy to be jealous of Boris Johnson's eternal optimism and to at least kind of understand why people are attracted to that, because I would love at this point to stick my head in the clouds and think that everything's going to be okay, and the fact that I can't is more concerning than anything else.
Yeah, well, it seems like Boris is going to have a hard time finding horrible situations for his end game, even if he ends up leaving the prime ministry, as I'm going to continue calling it, under some of the most shameful hypothetical circumstances imaginable, which I think is at least potentially on the table. But we will see. And again, maybe find ourselves back in here a year or two, however long from now, with another update. But I believe that is going to wrap it up for us today. Dom,
that's the thing. It's that for as much as Boris campaigned on a promise to get Brexit done, and in one sense has got Brexit done, Brexit will never officially be done, because it's not a finite process with a natural endpoint. It's a change to how we live our lives and the rules that we live under. And that's something which has implications in the short term, medium term, long term, for decades to come. So yeah, if we're still alive at this point, then I'm down for the 2054 Brexit update. Let's book it right now.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Brexit, as far as I would be concerned, and, you know, you're the philosophy major here, not me, but whenever it feels like rejoining the EU would be the radical shift that people are not used to, that, I would say, is when Brexit has finally sunk in. But that probably a ways off in the distance still to this point. But yes, I'm fully here for the 2054 Brexit update. But until then, he is on Twitter, of course, at DomHRV. I can be found at Colin Stone. For anyone who has been enjoying this podcast, who's more of a European politics person and does not know this, we are generally talking more about American reality TV, and if that is something that would interest you, certainly feel free to subscribe or find our old episodes on the whatever podcatcher you're using to hear this right now. Bonus episodes incidentally up every Saturday over on Patreon at patreon.com/DomandColin, but I believe that is finally going to get us out of here. So thank you guys who have made it this far. And again, thank you, Dom, for talking me through all of this. We will talk to you guys soon. Take care, everybody.